From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. The documentary E-Team, directed by Katie Cheveny and Ross Kaufman, focuses on four members of Human Rights Watch's emergencies team. The team travels to conflict zones all over the world to investigate and to determine whether or not allegations of human rights violations are founded. It also looks at what these people do in their downtime. E-Team received an award for Best Cinematography for an American documentary at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It was also screened earlier this month at the True-False Film Fest here in Columbia, which looks at documentary filmmaking. Global Journalist producer Raymond Tungekar spoke with E-Team's directors about their film and the work of Human Rights Watch's emergencies team.
How did you get the idea for the film?
Ross and I both are filmmakers and friends that we've known each other for a long time. And 10 years ago, Ross made Born into Brothels and it premiered at Sundance and then went on to win the Academy Award in 2005. And that same year, I made a film called Deadline that also premiered at Sundance. And because our films were in the same festival circuit, Ross and I became friends and colleagues, and we were looking for a project to work on together. And we were aware of Human Rights Watch's work, the work of the organization, partly because both of us had had those same films in the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. So they were aware of our work as well. And but we had no idea whether their work would be good for a film. It wasn't until we met with the members of the E-Team themselves and we had dinner with all of them. And they were just such incredible characters. They were the kind of people you meet and think there should be a movie about these guys. And I think both Ross and I felt the same way after meeting them. And so we spent some time after that talking to them and talking to each other and raising money. And then we went ahead and took the plunge and said, let's try to make a film about these particular individuals, these members of the E-Team.
And how did you approach Human Rights Watch and get them on board? Because, you know, in this film, you have incredible access to the E-Team.
Many filmmakers over the years have approached Human Rights Watch to try to film some aspect of their organization. And when we got together with Human Rights Watch, they were very clear. They knew our work and they really knew us in a way. And they felt like we would be able to tell a story about their organization. So they granted us access. Now, it's really important to understand that we were very clear with Human Rights Watch. We said, we have to have full creative control. We have to be able to show your organization warts and all. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts, because Katie and I are very clear. Like, we would never, ever partake in a film that we had anything but full creative control.
Yeah, and it is important to note that this is the first time that Human Rights Watch has granted this kind of access to a filmmaking team. So we're very privileged to have that access. We took it as a great honor and a responsibility. And like Ross said, you know, we weren't out to make a film that just talked about a nonprofit organization. We really wanted to make a film that was about some fascinating characters who happened to do some really incredible work.
So you said earlier that you were aware of, you were familiar with Human Rights Watch and what they do, but has your impression of them, and Katie, we can start with you, has your impression of Human Rights Watch changed since you made this film?
I mean, certainly when you make a film like this, you learn a great deal more about an organization than you did in the beginning. But I think the main thing that we learned was on a much more human scale, because we weren't going in depth to profile an organization. Once you see the film, you'll see we were spending lots of time at home with these particular people, Anya and Ula and Fred and Peter. And what we really got to know was them and their work and their approach to their work. So I speak for both me and Ross when I think our understanding was really deepened about how people could go about doing difficult work like investigating human rights abuses abroad, what goes into that, what makes them want to do it, what makes them keep doing it. Those were all the questions we were most interested in. And so that's the kind of thing that we were really exploring.
Okay. And you mentioned the four characters that you focus on. Could you describe them in greater detail?
They're kind of like a human rights mod squad, you know, where like there's the Anya's the Russian, very tough, chain smoking, very, you know, wears wonderful clothes and also never takes no for an answer, like that kind of combination of traits.
The fiery and then there's Russian.
Yeah, right. She's like the fiery Russian. And then there's Fred. You describe Fred, Ross.
Fred's a nice guy from New York. He's just a sweet, funny, affable, and has a goofy sense of humor. And then you play that against Peter, who's this sort of tough guy originally from Belgium. And Peter can definitely rub people sometimes the right way and sometimes the wrong way. And then there's Ule, who is married to Anya, and Ule is a very placid, relaxed Norwegian. So the combination of all these characters together is what Katie and I, that's what we really reacted to. Any one of these characters would have made a great film, we thought, but the combination of all of them really just added to the sense of a team and a very diverse team.
Earlier, you referenced having dinner with some E-Team members. Was it those four?
Yes, that's right. Those are the people. Yeah. So we had dinner with them very early on, many years ago, when this was just an idea. And we were kind of eyeing each other warily, like, did we really want to take the plunge to do this long-term project together, which would involve really a lot of intimate access of, you know, between all of us. And none of us were willing to say yes to that right away. We really had to get to know each other before we felt confident and before the trust was built that enabled us to make the film we made.
You know, Katie pulled up an email from the fall of 2007. Which was the first email that we exchanged about the possibility of doing this film. So the film has actually been in the making quite a while.
Can you talk about how you eventually broached the subject of filming them and gaining this intimate access into their lives?
Well, that came up at dinner. I mean, but you know, the reason we had dinner with them is because we'd had a meeting with Human Rights Watch about the possibility of making a movie, and we'd been very forthright, as Ross described, of saying we need to have editorial control and we need to have a lot of access and we need to make a great story. This can't just be a kind of airbrushed portrait of a nonprofit doing good work. That's not what we're interested in making. We want to make a film that feels like a movie. You know, that's a great story and a great ride, a great watch, and super entertaining. And maybe some of those elements are somewhat different than whatever the agenda Human Rights Watch has. So in order to get to the bottom of whether that was even possible, we had this dinner with them, with Anya and Ule. And Peter and Fred, and they were initially, they really liked the idea of a film that had that kind of access, but they didn't know us. They didn't know Ross and myself. I mean, they knew of our reputation, so they knew we knew how to handle human rights subject matter sensitively and thoughtfully, but they also needed to like us and trust us, and so that took time. But immediately while we were at dinner, we were having a very clear conversation. You know, I think Ross is very forthright, and he was saying, you know, we would want to be with you at home. We want to film you when things aren't going well for you, as well as when things are, you know, going well. So we would need to have that whole picture, and you would need to feel comfortable about that. So, I mean, that's part of what you need to do as a documentary filmmaker, is have those kinds of conversations with your subjects.
Okay.
And yeah, we were very clear that, you know, this would have to be 24/7 access. You know, whenever we needed to come to their apartments, to their homes, and visit with their families, we'd need to have that access. And much to their credit, they pretty much right away said, okay, they understood what we wanted to do. And they said yes.
So how long were you in Libya and Syria? I guess, how long was the actual filming process?
It's funny because a film like this with the Verite Films, you never really know what the story is going to be. We were at a planning meeting, one of the first shoots that we shot, a meeting in New York. You know, it's a little bit strange where they're trying to plan emergencies, but, you know, they have a yearly I think is it twice a year, Katie, that they get together?
Yeah, twice a year.
These planning meetings. So in January of 2011, there was no such thing as the Arab Spring. And their main issue, their main focus was Pakistan at that point. Little did they know, less than a month later, you know, the Middle East would basically have this huge upheaval. And so we didn't even know where we were going most of the time. At a certain point, Libya had started flaring up, and I think it was February 17th exactly. And we were waiting to get funding. We didn't have the funds to go right out and follow the E-Team into Libya and through the revolution. So we finally got funding towards, what was it, over the summer, Katie?
Yeah, like in the middle of 2011, we got some money, and therefore we were able to film. Ross was able to go to Libya in the fall of 2011, and that was our first shoot that was, you know, overseas.
Yeah, in September of 2011. So it's funny with these kinds of films, because with Verite Films, you know, it's not just about when you want to shoot, it's when you can shoot. And this film could have been very different if we got funding in February of 2011. It could have been all about Libya with the beginning of Syria as, you know, part of the film. And instead, it's become mostly about Syria and about our characters and their interactions in Syria, with Libya filling and rounding out the story. To answer your question, I think in September of 2011, I went to Libya, spent about 10 days to 2 weeks there with our crew as our crew. I mean, I was the only whenever we go into war zones, it's a one-man band, as they call it. So I went in alone, but I went with Fred and Peter, two of our characters, into Libya, and it was right as Tripoli was falling to the rebels. So literally, we drove in through Tunisia into Libya, and the city of Tripoli was deserted, other than a few... other than rebels and journalists, for the most part, there was no one else really out on the street. And that was fascinating to see, that literally within 7 days, people of Tripoli coming out onto the streets and getting acclimated to a world without Gaddafi. And then in Syria, and we, Katie, interrupt me, please, if I'm rambling.
Well, I mean, we filmed in Syria about four different times over the course of, from spring of 2012 through spring of 2013. So we have a real interesting picture of how things were changing in Syria over that year through the eyes of our characters. In this case, it was Anya and Ule who were going back to Syria again and again to document the abuses that were occurring there.
And we had an incredible cinematographer named Rachel Beth Anderson, who went in with Anya and Ule for the first two trips to Syria. And she spent about 4 weeks total, I think, in Syria with them, and really shot some incredible footage. And then I spent about 10 days with Anya and Ule in the fall, I think, it was the spring of 2013 in Syria. So, yeah, as Katie said, we really had quite an interesting perspective on the changes that happened in Syria during that time.
And at what point did these two, you know, these shoots in Libya and Syria begin to form into like a cohesive whole where you felt like the movie was coming together in a way that made sense to release it?
About 2 days before we finished editing the film, that's when things started to really come together. It's interesting. Our producer, Marilyn Ness, who is just on top of everything, and she was constantly reading the papers, getting Google alerts, trying to figure out when the right time to go into Syria was, because, you know, we can't spend, you know, months and months and months in Syria, and we could only go when our E-team went. So we had to choose very carefully the times when we went into Syria, when we went into different areas of the world. So Marilyn was key in keeping up on the news and really basically calling us at a moment's notice saying, you know what, it's time. You have to go to Syria. Get on a plane now.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, when you're making a film, while you're shooting it, you kind of have a sense of like, well, I think this is what the beginning of the movie will be. I think this is what the ending will be. And I would say this was not that kind of movie. I mean, we had so much footage documenting so many complicated little stories and big stories from Libya and Syria and about our characters and Anya, you know, Anya's personal life. I'm sorry, I was about to give something away. I have to stop myself. We had so much interesting footage. We had over 350 hours of footage that was shot by our team. And it was really hard for us in the middle of that. We almost had like a fog of war about the film, if you will. Like, we weren't exactly sure what the story was. And when you're in that kind of situation, you typically make the story in the edit room. And I would say that's what happened with this film. We had a great editor, David Teague, who spent basically a year working on this film, and he plowed through all the footage. And was in constant contact with Ross and myself about what we thought was the strongest material. And he then would come back to us and say, I have a sense that this story is very strong. And we would give him some feedback on that and go back and forth. And so really the film got built in terms of figuring out what was the beginning, the middle, and end, where was the drama, where was the part that would draw people in. That all happened through the editing process, which is a really exciting part of documentary filmmaking.
And one of the key ingredients to the film is not just the war zones. We spent many weeks with our characters in their homes, in Berlin, in Geneva, in Moscow, in Paris. One of the key parts of this film is getting to know our characters at home and with their families and trying to really understand why they go and do what they do, but also how they manage having families and having a life outside of the work or alongside the work, as the case may be.
You both touched upon this already, but could you talk about some of the biggest challenges when making this film?
One challenge that Ross often talks about is it's very challenging making a film that's in cinema verite style like this, where we didn't know what the story was. We didn't know what was going to happen in Libya and Syria, obviously. We couldn't look in a crystal ball and know. And yet we had to make judgment calls about whether or not to spend the money and resources to get on a plane and go to Libya, Syria, Paris, wherever, and do some filming. So you're taking these kind of leaps of faith throughout in terms of yes, we got a grant last week. Okay, let's spend half of it and go do some filming in Paris. And that is a very challenging aspect, both financially and mentally, because you need to keep believing that the story is coming and that your travel to these places and you're continuing to film is helping to make the film better. So that's kind of a certain kind of challenge that not all films require, but this one certainly did.
And another huge challenge, let's not forget, Katie, is that pretty much everyone who was involved with the film had babies during the making of this film. Katie has a 2-year-old daughter. I now have a 3-year-old son. Anya, Ole, Fred, Peter, everyone's had babies. And, you know, just managing life as a documentary filmmaker when you have a newborn child is quite a challenge.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today, we're looking at the film E-Team. The documentary examines the role of Human Rights Watch's emergencies team, which travels to conflict zones to examine human rights violations. We've just heard from producer Raymond Tungekar, who spoke with E-Team's directors, Katie Cheveny and Ross Kaufman. I'd like to remind you that you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That's globaljournalist.org. You can also find links to other stories related to this broadcast, including the review of E-Team and articles focusing on the war in Syria. For more Global Journalist content, you can also like us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. One of the subjects of the film E-Team is Ole Solvang. He spoke with Global Journalist's David Reed back in February of 2012 about the work he did in Syria during the country's civil war.
Ole, Human Rights Watch put out a report today, I believe. What are the highlights of that report about what's happening in Syria?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, since last Friday, the Syrian military forces have launched large-scale attacks on several populated areas in Syria, and one of the places that has been worst affected is the city of Homs, which is the third largest city in Syria and has been a bit of a center for the anti-government demonstrations. For 5 or 6 days now, the government forces have been basically surrounding these populated areas, preventing people from leaving, preventing people from entering this area. They have cut electricity, they have blocked food delivery and medicine delivery into the area, and they have been shelling shelling the area with no concern in terms of how many civilians are being killed. And it is incredibly hard to get accurate information out about what is going on, but we believe that at this point more than 300 people have been killed in less than a week from this shelling.
What's the environment like for journalists in Syria? And Uli, how does this compare with what you're hearing and finding out in Syria?
I think it is absolutely accurate. I think it is extremely difficult and dangerous at this point to get information verified. There are ways of doing that, and we always try to verify to the extent possible information before we put it out. And there's different ways. We try to track down the people who have filmed the incident in question and uploaded it on YouTube, or we try to talk to other witnesses who were present at the scene of the incident. There, it is becoming extremely difficult, particularly when the army is launching large-scale military operations, because as a rule, they usually cut electricity, they cut phone lines as well. So getting through to people is extremely difficult, and the only people in many cases we're able to reach are those that have satellite phones. But in addition to that, I think one of the very important ways that we at least use to verify information is by going to the neighboring countries and talk to refugees, talk to defectors from the military, interview them at length, and in that way being able to verify some of the information that have come out on YouTube, or on blogs, or in other ways.
Yes, I noticed in your report you interview people separately, cross-reference details. What are some other ways that, and I know you've been using defectors from the army also to bolster the case that there are crimes against humanity here. Could you talk about that, the way you use these defectors from the army?
Well, I mean, there are different ways that we approach our research, and there are different ways in which we verify our research, and the methodology that we use on Syria is no different from the methodology that we use in many other countries. Most of the information that we collect is based on in-depth, detailed interviews with firsthand witnesses. And very often those are victims themselves, or they can be witnesses. What is really unique in many ways about the situation in Syria is that there is such a large number of defectors who have left the country that we can interview. And that has really given us a very detailed insight in terms of how the military and the security agencies are structured, where they are deployed, who are the commanders, who gave orders to do what. So a report that we put out in December was based on interviews with more than 60 of these defectors. And in that report, we named more than 70 officers and commanders who we believed should be investigated for their role in the crackdown on demonstrators, violations that we believe are crimes against humanity.
Right. Sounds like you're building a court case. How do you court your sources, and how do you ensure them that they will be safe if they return, or that their families are going to be safe?
Well, I think in all our research, and particularly in Syria, where we know that the security and intelligence agencies are so active, they have such a wide network and such a wide reach, and they're so brutal, the safety of witnesses and the people we speak to is really paramount for us. And that's something that really plays into the entire research process, from how we approach people. We always try to make sure that people have a choice whether they talk to us or not, so that they're not suddenly just finding themselves in a room with a bunch of foreigners and only then find out that it is, you know, this international human rights organization that they are supposed to speak with, to making sure that the information that we collect, that it's stored safely, that it is encrypted if it is on computers, and to the way that we publish the information, making sure that we, if people have requested anonymity, that we do not disclose any information about their identity, any other information that can help somebody identify who they are. And in Syria in particular, as a rule, particularly when we talk to victims, it's better to be safe than sorry. So in those cases, we have insisted on anonymity for all our victims.
Yeah, but speaking of that, Ule, what's the Human Rights Watch strategy forward? Are they going to try to build a case against the Assad regime?
We are going to continue to do our work, and which is to document these violations, to publish information about these violations, and then to try to end them. And of course, a lot of the information that we are collecting will hopefully someday be part of an investigation and prosecution of those who were responsible. Whether that takes place in domestic courts in Syria at some time in the future, or whether the Security Council decides to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court, we don't know yet. But we are convinced, based on all the conflicts that we worked in, that ending impunity, holding people responsible for the violations, is needed for there to be a long-lasting peace and for there to be justice. And of course, it is extremely important for the victims of these violations.
That was David Reed speaking to Ole Solvang in February 2012. Solvang was one of the subjects of the documentary E-Team, which looks at those who investigate human rights violations in conflict zones. That's all for this edition of Global Journalists, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our executive producer is Casey Morell, with assistance from Raymond Tungekar. Join us again next time for another edition of Global Journalists. I'm Jim Blink.